Chapter 3, Rhythm Control.
Hey, we got everyone in the fishbowl for a second, so let's have a quick talk. So we have Janelle Lee, we have John Ramos, and Jimmy McHugh. What's up? You coming on shift?
Yep, I'm just starting.
Okay, great. So we're looking after this guy with new onset AFib, and it looks like he probably has some heart failure too, right, Janelle?
Yes.
Okay, so we have some options here that we want to talk about for how we can treat him. What are some choices? Just throw him out. What are some options to try to get him out of this rhythm?
You can try procainamide.
We could shock him.
So we can do rate control on these patients also, either with calcium channel blockers or with beta blockers also.
So I think the residents hit it right off the bat. The options are rhythm control, which you can do chemically or electrically. Then there's rate control, and we're going to talk about that in much greater detail in a couple minutes. And then finally, there's a third option, which is basically to do nothing.
Yeah, they didn't mention that.
Stand there and watch. Now, why, Stuart, why would you do that? Why would you just stand there and watch them?
That's a really great point. So remember how we were talking about the fact that, you know, AFib just happens in a lot of patients that we see, but AFib might be the presentation of something really bad, like a pulmonary embolus or a GI bleed, or anything else that makes someone really sick, any type of shock. And so in those cases, the rate of the AFib might be partially in response to increased needs for cardiac output.
Right.
And so if a patient's in AFib with a rate of around, say, 130 to 140, and we had mentioned that to a certain point of heart rate, that increases their cardiac output and might be helping them compensate. And so if you took every patient that came in with a heart rate of 130 to 140 and tried to push it down, the ones that really needed it because they were sick because of underlying sepsis or PE, you could kill them.
Right.
And so you're only looking to control the rate in patients that don't otherwise need that rate because they just spontaneously flipped into AFib because of an underlying heart disease.
Right. And so if there is some other illness that's driving the AFib, of course, you're treating the underlying illness. Just controlling the rate, you're more likely to do more harm than good by doing that. So this is a very complex decision about what to choose for how we're going to manage the patient's rate or rhythm. So what are some of the factors that we need to consider in order to make that decision?
Yeah, so like you said, it's the rate, it's the rhythm that we're concerned about, and it's their anticoagulation status. Those are the three things. And so while I'm thinking about what I'm going to do about those three things, the things that feed into that decision are what are the cause? Because obviously the cause is a thyroid problem. The treatment's going to be a lot different than if it's from alcohol withdrawal or if it's from a pulmonary embolus, for example, right? The symptoms that they're having are really important. So if a person's very symptomatic, that's going to lead you towards converting the rhythm because it's really bothering them, for example.
Right.
If they don't notice it at all, that will be less compelling, all other things being equal, to treat them because they don't feel any symptoms. So that plays into it as well. Chronicity really plays an important role. If someone's been in AFib for 5 years, you're not going to get them out of AFib for that long.
No,
the heart kind of gets set into that pattern. And so if it's a more recent onset, that's going to make you more likely to want to convert a rhythm, for example. And the comorbidities are incredibly important. For starters, anything that makes them a bleeding risk. They're a bad bleeding risk. They've got brain tumors or spinal tumors, for example, or diabetes that has bloody retinopathy that's going to make them blind if they bleed. Those things are contraindications to an absolute or relative extent to anticoagulation. And that's also a huge factor that feeds into your management.
So let's get into the rhythm control and who is a candidate for rhythm control. When we say rhythm control, we're talking about cardioversion.
I've got rhythm. Oh, sorry. When we say rhythm control, we're talking about taking a bad rhythm, like AFib, and making it
sinus.
It's a good rhythm that we like. That's what it means, you know?
And the key thing that we want to know, probably the most important element of the history, is the time of onset. That is so important. If the patient can tell you, oh, I was sitting there and I was having my morning coffee and then boom, I felt these palpitations. It was at 8:30.
By the way, you know how you get that answer from patients? It took me like 20 years to figure this out.
How do you do it?
What were you doing at the time when you noticed this symptom, this fluttering in your heart? That's the way you ask that because, you know, the ones where it was sudden onset can identify the time.
That moment,
because, oh, yeah,
they know
that's right. I was eating my pastrami sandwich and I took a bite and all of a sudden, you know. That's sudden onset.
I was eating my bagel and lox.
All right, sitting there having my coffee.
And all of a sudden.
Now I'm getting a little verklempt.
Okay, so, and the time window that you need to know is 48 hours, because that's sort of the generally accepted time window, at least right now.
Right. Like, it's safe to say that it's a continuum. Obviously, the longer you've been in this atrial fibrillation, the longer clots have had time to form in that not working well atrium where, you know, it's the blood's not circulating. It's just, you know, the atrium is fibrillating, so clots as time goes on, start to settle there. So 48 hours is just sort of a compromise that most people aren't going to have big clots that are going to cause a stroke, but some actually will. So the longer it's been, the more uneasy you are about converting that rhythm to sinus.
Now, this 48-hour window, it's a little bit controversial, and there's no clinical policy on this as of now. But if you want to hear more about this, then there is a great discussion on MRAP May 2017, where Rob Orman and Anand Swaminathan discuss a new Canadian paper about that 48-hour time window. And there's also an interesting discussion, if you listen to EMA from April of 2017, that's Swami and Ken Milne, and they go into a further discussion about that paper as well. So time of onset is really important, but let's go back to our patient for a moment here. He's sick, and if he suddenly is to decompensate, and let's say now I feel like I have to cardiovert him, is that safe? Is that okay to do that?
It is, it is. And as a patient becomes more and more unstable, the risk-benefit equation totally shifts towards, well, yes, there's a few percent risk of stroke here, but this guy's dying.
Right.
And so you have to get that rate down somehow or another in that crashing patient. And the fastest way to do that is often to deliver electricity. But you should keep in mind that when you convert those patients to a sinus rhythm, mm-hmm. you get the rate down so they're more efficient in their heart rate, and their stroke volume is more efficient. But don't be under any illusion that you've fixed the contraction of the atrium and that you've restored that atrial kick, that process of the atrium filling the ventricle when the atrium contracts. Actually, patients that have been AFib for a long time, they actually have an electrical stunning phenomena where it might take several days, even weeks, for that atrium to get back to the contracting that it's doing.
And that's really confusing. So even though I'm seeing sinus rhythm on an ECG and I'm seeing P waves now, you're telling me that doesn't mean that the atria are contracting
exactly
in a coordinated
right.
fashion.
Exactly right. Especially if they've been in AFib for a long time. It's going to take some time before that electrical pattern gets translated into an effective mechanical output of that atrium.
Right. So there's no kick of the blood flow into the ventricles.
And so you know what else that means? You know what else is a consequence of that, Jess? And
what's
I think
that?
This brings it all home, is that when you have that sick patient in CHF with the high heart rate, mm-hmm. you want to just bring the heart rate down.
Yes.
Now, you can cardiovert them to do that, but it carries the extra risk of stroke, not to mention it's scary and you have to give, sedation and stuff. If you can get away with just lowering the heart rate with an AV nodal blocker, just rate control medically with your diltiazem or with your beta blocker, that would be preferable.
Okay, so those are really good points to make. But first, before we talk about the nitty-gritty of rate control, let's talk about the when and how for electrical and chemical cardioversion. So, Stuart, starting with electrical cardioversion.
Okay, it hurts. It hurts bad. Okay, it's like, you've been told it's like a Mack truck hitting your chest and all these horrible things about cardioversion. So sedation's critically important.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to talk about that in detail now, but you give them something. And then basically, it takes more electricity than you would think to convert AFib. And so I usually start off with about 200 joules. I like it to work on the first time, and mm-hmm. it can be fairly electricity resistant. So I go with a fairly high dose on the first go. Fairly standard ACLS stuff, putting the pads, on either side of the heart, anterior, posterior is a good idea if you're having trouble with other equipment there and pacemakers and stuff. Then it's a matter of making sure everyone's clear and discharging that synchronized.
Did I mention that? That's key.
That synchronized cardioversion button and seeing if it does the trick.
Right. And run your ECG and go ahead and cardiovert. Now, some patients, you're going to shock and they're not going to convert. And I think then we have to start thinking about, what did I miss? There's got to be something else going on.
Well, the first thing you think is there another reason for this AFib that's underlying and driving this? And so that often will be the case in some of these sick medical patients.
Now, when it comes to chemical cardioversion, it's not quite as popular in the United States, but it is a common practice in a lot of other places, especially in Canada, notably for their Ottawa aggressive protocol. And what they did there is they're using procainamide, very common practice. So patient who's a stable, good candidate, new onset AFib, they give them a gram of procainamide, and if they're going to convert, they're going to convert in front of you. You're going to watch them convert to sinus rhythm.
It's a little bit resource intensive because while they're on that procainamide drip, it's not like you just give it and walk away.
Right.
You're sort of giving it as an infusion. You're watching to make sure their blood pressure doesn't go down and their QT doesn't prolong.
And just to be clear, that procainamide is not going in over a rapid push. That's going in as an infusion over about 1 hour.
So it's a little bit, more involved in some of the things that we're used to doing.
You've got to be standing by with a little fluid bolus if they get a little
hypotensive.
And the other thing is that it works about a coin flip of the time. So the patients who fail that are going to get shocked anyway.
Yeah, Yeah, and then once you've used that drug, you know, any other drugs after that, after the procainamide, mm-hmm. become very dangerous because you really put them at risk for QT prolongation.
So you are Canadian.
Yes.
And you prefer electricity.
Well, I'm both Canadian and American, so I straddle the argument, but there's a really great benefits to what they're doing in Canada. And in a lot of ways, we're behind them. I mean, they're getting these patients in and out of the emergency department much quicker.
Right.
And they've shown with, you know, a fair number of patients, it's pretty safe to do that. But we in the United States tend to be really hung up on stroke risk. And I think that is at the back of all our minds. And we really haven't jumped on that bandwagon.
And I think it's also a good option to think about for someone who's just terrified of the idea of electrical cardioversion and is not willing to do that. Then this is something you can discuss with them. Or someone who's not a good candidate for a procedural sedation. You know, maybe under the right circumstances, you could talk about procainamide and give that a try first. But I don't want to focus all our energy on procainamide, right? Because there's other agents. We just don't use them as often.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you've really got a whole host of options for chemical cardioversion, and some of them are quite safe and innocuous. Like magnesium is relatively safe mm-hmm. and might convert a decent number of people. And so that's something you can think about. And it's also safe in COPD. And, you know, mm-hmm. that's something to note because a lot of these patients also have that. Other options include Econide and Flecainide. These are 1C agents. Propafenone mm-hmm. has been used in a lot of centers and some of the American studies as well. One word of caution, though, is those 1C agents, and I know this is a lot of detail.
Tell me about 1C,
but those 1C
Stuart,
agents,
I want to know.
Those propafenones and those echinides and mm-hmm. those flecainides, they can be dangerous when they're given in patients with structural heart disease and CHF. And so in the United States, when we are doing chemical cardioversion, I think a lot of the cardiologists are more comfortable with amiodarone because it can be used in patients both with and without structural heart disease to convert AFib.
And the thing to know about amiodarone is that's great that you gave it. That doesn't mean they're going to convert to sinus rhythm anytime soon. The onset of action is much slower.
It might take a little more monitoring. Yeah.
They're not going to convert right in front of you.
And just to remind people, that's a class 3 agent, amiodarone, and those should be okay in patients with structural heart disease.
And there's just one final point that I want to make. We've talked about rhythm control now, but there's another option, which is to do nothing, to just do nothing and stand there and watch the patient, because about 50% of patients will just spontaneously cardiovert in 24 hours on their own. So some people put these patients in observation units and just see what happens by the morning.
Yeah, and along those lines, if they have been in AFib for a significant amount of time, you might also need to consider anticoagulating those patients because they still will be at risk for a clot for some time after they convert, if it was a long time that they were in AFib.
So again, to orient us, we're talking about rate control and rhythm control. So rhythm control is getting you back into sinus rhythm. A couple of the big issues they talked about there is you can do it with drugs or electricity. And even though you get them back into what looks like sinus rhythm on an EKG, they may not be contracting for days, 2 weeks, depending on how long they've had it. Now, if your AFib started 2 hours ago and I cardiovert you, you're likely to get that atrium contracting within a few minutes. But if you've been in atrial fib for 2 years and I decide I'm going to put you back in a sinus rhythm today and magically you can, or magically you do because usually you can't, then that atrium may not contract for a long time. So you still have to worry about these people throwing clots if it's been more than this magic 48 hours from symptom onset. So that's the cutoff we use. If you've been having atrial fibrillation for less than 48 hours, we're not so worried about you having created a clot and then stroking out. If it's been more than 48 hours, you need to at least echo the patient. And most people would say you need to anticoagulate them for a period of time before you try and get them back into sinus rhythm. All right. This is a lot of stuff that you probably are not going to do in the emergency department. You're going to be focused on just that less than 48 hours and then decide, should I put them back into sinus rhythm? Will I use electricity or will I use drugs? In the next section, they're going to be talking about rate control, just slowing the atrial fibrillation down so that you can get enough diastolic filling so you can get a good cardiac output. Don't worry about this converting them back to sinus rhythm stuff.